Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You're listening to the lecture on vulnerabilities of working migrants and migrant children in the global economy by Samuel Okiere, a senior lecturer in sociology at the School of Sociology, Politics and International Studies at the University of Bristol. Samuel is a founding member of the Beyond Trafficking and Slavery Hub on Open Democracy. He specializes in critical reflections on the interplay between human rights, power, inequality, ethnicity, and class under conditions of globalization. He has pursued this interest through extensive research on precocious migration, trafficking, and labor mobility involving both adults and children. Enjoy the lecture.
Thank you very much, and good to see you all. Thanks for coming. So my talk this afternoon is going to focus on the challenges facing migrant workers in the global economy. And I've broken it into three main segments. I'm going to start by taking a broad look at the status of migrant workers, international migrant workers more specifically. And then we will look at the challenges or the issues facing this category of people, at the end of which we shall try to explore some of the solutions to the issues we've identified. Now, my teaching normally is very dialogical, and I do want it to be collaborative. So as with the earlier session, I will ask for some audience participation to make it more engaging. And so with that in mind, I have a first question for the audience. Who is a migrant worker? What do we understand of that term?
I am a migrant worker.
Okay. Yes, thank you. How do we define the term is the question I'm trying to find out. I guess a clue is in the name, isn't it? But how do we define it? Is anybody here a migrant worker, apart from Katerina and myself? Let's see by hands those of us who identify as migrant workers, either now or in the past or at some other point in time. Okay, so a fair amount of us. So someone who went to another place, it could be in the same country or another region or town. Do we all agree with, in their own country, do we all agree with that definition? Okay, thank you. Now, the curious thing is that in international rights discourse, migrant workers are defined primarily in relation to those who have moved across borders, as you can see from the two definitions on the screen. So the UN Convention on the Protection of All Migrant Workers and Their Families, one of the conventions I love the most, says that a migrant worker is one who is to be engaged or has been engaged in a remunerated or paid activity in a state of which he or she is not a national. Similarly, the ILO Convention number 97, the Migration for Employment Convention, defines a migrant worker as one who has migrated from one country to another with a view to being employed otherwise than on his own account, and includes any person regularly admitted as a migrant for employment. And so we have a slight issue with these definitions, because we know that in lay understanding, a migrant is not only one who migrates across borders. We know that migration takes place internally as well. And so as I'm saying, we have a slight sort of dispute with these definitions, because in the context of migration for labor, we know that far more occurs internally within our own countries than migration which occurs outside. And I think part of the problem comes down to the fact that there is no sort of universal I guess there is no universal accepted definition for the term migrant itself, at least one in international law. A migrant is not actually defined in any legal sort of context in international law. But I guess in common understanding, a migrant refers to anybody who has left his or her usual place of residence to another, and this can be across borders, it can be in the country where they live, and so on and so forth. And so the problem is really an important one, as we shall see later. The exclusion of internal migrants or internal migrant, domestic migrant workers from the definition is really important because a lot of the challenges which domestic migrant workers face are often not too dissimilar from those which are facing those who move across borders. And when we think of countries such as Thailand, Indonesia, Nigeria, certainly China, South Africa, and India, notably, we know that many millions of people seek work outside their own cities and towns, and we saw how in the pandemic following the lockdown in India, many millions were compelled to walk long distances in an attempt to go back to their hometowns and cities with a lot of challenges along the way. But the fundamental point is that migrant workers' definition in international discourse refers to the one on the screen. And when I was called upon to give this lecture, I was really delighted for a couple of reasons. First of all, I am a migrant worker myself, and I have experienced some of the issues which I will be talking about today. But the topic also falls within my research and scholarly interest, secondly. But the third point is that this is a really large population of workers across the globe. Research by the ILO, estimates by the ILO, as I have outlined on the screen, show that of the millions of migrants that there are in the world, 169 of us are migrant workers. And that is approximately, I think, about 5% of the global workforce. I'm not going to go through all the stats on the screen, but I'll be very kind of brief. I'll touch on some points of them. We earlier saw the gendered dimension of migration. And as you can see, men, migrant workers make up 58.5% of the 169 million, and 41.5% are women. And what the ILO data tells us, this disparity, the difference, is also maps onto the number of migrants in the world generally. It shows the gendered dimension of migration, because women very often have more obstacles in terms of being able to migrate for labor. They face a lot more challenges, and that explains the discrepancy to an extent. When we think of the sectors in which migrant workers are also involved, we can see that the vast majority, as shown there on the screen, are in the services sector. So these are the kinds of jobs such as care work and in hotels and bars and other arenas. Agricultural labor makes up 7.1% of the global migrant labor workforce. And then in industry, we have 26.7%. Now, this obviously refers solely to those in the formal sector. There isn't the same sort of data set available in the informal sector for a variety of reasons. Obviously, this is a lot more difficult population to reach, and so finding them and counting them, for that matter, is a lot more challenging. In relation to where migrant workers are located, we can see that two-thirds of the estimated 169 million migrant workers work in high-income countries. 33.3 is almost 20%. are in upper middle income countries and 9.5% in lower middle income countries and 3.6% in low income countries. So what this really tells us is that Northern America, Western Europe and the Arab Gulf states benefit from 86.9% of the international migrant labor workforce. Pretty much most of the international migrant labor workforce are found in these three regions of the world. That can be seen again from the charts provided by the ILO. And in fact, in Western Europe and North America, almost one in five workers are of a migrant background, rising all the way to nearly one in two in some of the Gulf states. So their contributions, as you can appreciate, to these countries are really substantial. If you imagine that nearly half of the workforce in some countries are migrants. Final demographic point I want us to look at is the age factor, in part because my research involves child migrants, independent child migrants, young people who move mainly without adults of their own volition in search of employment and other opportunities. It is true that the majority of global migrants or labor migrants are in what is called the prime labor age, mainly aged from 25 to 64. However, there is an increasing amount of youth migrant workers, defined here as people who are aged 15 to 24. And this category is counted because, as we know, I hope some of us know, the legal minimum age for employment is 15. That is not to say that there aren't those who are below this age who are working, as we again well know, and we shall look at that category of workers as well. But primarily, most migrant workers are aged 25 to 64. However, the category of those aged 15 to 24 is on the ascendancy, rising from 8.3% of the global labor force in migrant labor force in 2017 to what it is now, which is 10%. And I think, therefore, that the peculiar challenges, given that this is an increasing category of workers, the challenges and the issues facing them deserve urgent attention so that we can address them before they become more pronounced. Because of, you know, you think about rising youth unemployment in a lot of countries. I am originally from Ghana, where over 50% of university graduates are not in employment. The same applies in a lot of countries worldwide, where young people are increasingly finding themselves unable to find the kinds of jobs which they want. And this is as well as development and welfare opportunities. And this is therefore driving a desire among this group of people to migrate, which is one of the reasons, as we know, that many migrant workers seek the opportunities that they do. But of course, it's important to stress that the factors underpinning labor migration are symbiotic. It's not simply that people want opportunities. As I've said before, in some countries, almost 50% or half of the labor workforce are migrants. So migrant labor is also highly desired by a lot of countries. Think about the aging population of many countries in the Northern Hemisphere. Think about the sorts of skills and cultural experiences and alternative viewpoints and other major contributions which migrant workers make, which are therefore, which therefore makes them highly desired as a labor workforce by many countries over the world. And so the key thing to remember is that it is very much symbiotic. migrants desire opportunities and work. At the same time, many countries also actively seek out the opportunities and the skills and contributions which both skilled, and I really hate this word, unskilled. I think everybody's skilled except that we value and decide these things differently. But, you know, in the literature, the skills of laborers, both skilled and unskilled, are highly sought after. Whether this is to do the menial jobs that many people in home countries do not want to do, or to work in the very highly skilled sectors that migrant workers find themselves in. But the other contribution, which I think, so, you know, beyond the contributions which migrant workers make to economic development and the growth of the countries in which they find themselves, they also make enormous contributions to their home countries, because I'm trying to remember the statistics, but remittances sent home from migrants as a broad category, many of whom are migrant workers, as we saw on the first slide, far outweigh the amount of foreign aid which some poor countries of the world receive. So the remuneration, the remittances, all the monies and other things which migrant workers send back home keep their homes, keep their economies and other aspects of their societies ticking along. So it's really hard to, I think, overestimate the contributions which people who identify as migrant workers make, both to the receiving countries, but also to the places they have left behind. And of course, when we return home, when migrant workers go back home, we take along with us the skills, the culture, the opportunities, the world views which we have picked up and also sort of developed along the way. So I think it's really, as I say, hard to overestimate the contributions which migrant workers make throughout the world. And yet, for all these contributions by both skilled and unskilled migrant workers in both the formal and informal sectors, many face immense challenges to their labor rights, their dignity, their economic and social rights, and wider human rights, as we shall now start to explore. So as summarized there on the screen, in both formal and informal context, among both skilled and unskilled migrant workers, numerous human rights violations are recorded in the literature, recorded by international humanitarian organizations, recorded by labor unions and others. International and domestic migrant workers alike face challenges in relation to accessing a whole range of human rights provisions, which domestic or sort of citizen workers, those who are nationals of the country, do not usually face. I think it's really hard to say this without feeling somewhat emotional about it, because one of the defining features of freedom, at least in the labor sector, is that as workers, we are all free to dispense with our labor power as we see fit. If I am not happy with my university's terms of employment, I simply hand in my notice and I walk away once the notice is ended. But that is not the case for a lot of migrant workers, for reasons we shall see later. But, you know, from recruitment processes through to treatment at the workplace, through to just the sheer social relations that they endure, migrant workers face many more insecurities compared to those who are nationals of the countries where they work. And whereas in mainstream migration and migrant labor discourse, we tend to place much emphasis on the informal, on the activities of criminal gangs and of evil or malevolent or rogue employers, in reality, many of these insecurities are in effect sanctioned by the state. The kinds of laws we put in place enable a lot of these challenges which migrants face, ranging from the kinds of migration regimes we put in place to the kinds of labor restrictions that are placed on people who are in this category, and so on and so forth. These tend to create a lot of the insecurities which migrant workers face. And I'm sure, as many of us are aware, probably one of the most significant of these is the issue of tied visas. And we're thinking here of the formal sector. The issue of sponsorship or tied visas. And as I was saying earlier, when we think about freedom in liberal democratic states, at least in the labor market, a worker is free to use or sell their labor power to whoever they desire and retract or withdraw it as they see fit. But this is only applicable only insofar as the state allows the person to be able to do this. So the situation of many migrant workers raises questions about our very understanding of freedom itself. If you imagine the fact that in the context of tied visas, people who are seeking work are bound to specific employers, making their legal status applicable only insofar as they are working with that particular employer. They become, in effect, illegalized overnight if they were to leave their employer. And we see this in many countries over the world. I think most EU countries have got forms of sponsorship visas. It became an issue of global attention. You know, the kafala system, which exists in the Gulf states during the World Cup, we heard a lot about it. And I remember some of my students went on demonstrations about it, and we're having a conversation, and I asked them, but what of the situation of overseas domestic workers in the UK, many of whom endure conditions that are not dissimilar to those which we were talking about in the context of the Gulf, because as organizations such as Kalayan have shown in the UK context, many overseas domestic workers, because of the nature of visa they have, you know, bound to their employers, have found themselves working under conditions where their hours of work are not clearly defined. They are pretty much at the beck and call of their employer because they live in the person's house. So whereas you could say you work a 9-to-5, for a lot of these migrant domestic workers, that is not the case. They could be asked to help with the childcare at 2 a.m. or at, you know, whatever odd hour the employer wants them to work. Many of them do not get many of the sorts of labor rights which many of us get in our workplaces and so on and so forth. So whereas you know, my students were thinking of the Gulf state as the only places where these rights violations of migrant workers occur, the reality is that in many Western liberal democratic states, these challenges also exist, and they are perfectly legal. I mean, the states concerned would say that they don't sanction that form of oppression. But as I said earlier, the problem is that once you put in place certain legal measures that create such immense power imbalances between any employee, not just a migrant worker. Obviously, the status of being a migrant already comes with its challenges. But once you create a scenario where an employee's very legality, in scare quotes, is dependent on the person for whom they work, you set in place the kinds of scenarios and situations that we see confronting the people who are in some of the cases that I have just mentioned. It creates an immense power imbalance, rendering workers vulnerable to gross exploitation and abuse, because employees hold immense power over the livelihoods and the lives of the migrant workers who are tied to them legally. And this leaves them with very limited recourse in cases where they are facing mistreatment or unfair working conditions. They also restrict the mobility of the workers in question, and this means that they are effectively prevented from seeking better opportunities. Again, thinking of the labor rights dimension, the notion of freedom in the context of labor. If I'm not happy with my employer, if I find a better job, I can always leave to seek that out. That is not the case for a lot of migrant workers. So their earnings, their labor rights, and you know, a lot of other rights are effectively curtailed by the law itself, not by unscrupulous employers or by criminal gangs, by the law of the country itself. Now, a linked problem as well, which I want to flag up, is that employers and the industry of third-party agents who recruit overseas domestic, overseas workers or migrant workers have risen exponentially over the last couple of decades. I think that as of 2013, there were over 260,000 recruitment agencies worldwide. And the simple fact is that it is a very lucrative area for many because they get commission, rightly so, for their work from employers. But many also operate in quite egregious ways. They charge the migrant workers fees that are not necessarily legal or sanctioned at all. And although international law protects all migrants, regardless of their status, whether they are sort of in scare quotes legal or illegal, again, words I kind of don't like to use for people. Although international law protects all workers regardless of their status, we find that work that occurs in the informal sector especially is completely missed out in any of these protections. And so with recruitment agencies, the fees they charge very often leave workers in a lot of debt. In research done in Spain and France and elsewhere, it was found that people recruiting for some factories from North Africa and elsewhere are charging the migrant workers sums in excess of a whole year's salary, and this leaves many people in debt back home, unable to pay off the amount because they are not earning enough to pay it off, and this means they have to consistently stay in employment, which is not attractive, which has got very poor remuneration, which has got poor working conditions, and so on and so forth. So many of the laws that relate to migrant workers actually fall short of the protections that all workers should in reality enjoy. As I'm saying, there have been a lot of recruitment agencies, and this has become an arena through which migrant workers find themselves again quite often in full glare of the law, enduring conditions of labor that are far from adequate, ranging from wage theft in terms of the low pay they receive through to things like manipulation, physical and sexual abuse, among other violence as well. In fact, I think in Canada, Singapore, and the UK, one in five migrant workers who use the services of migrant recruitment agencies have turned up only to find that the jobs they were promised were non-existent. Or even if they were, the terms under which they signed their contracts were very different to those which they encountered. And yet many have had to go through with it because they have paid a lot of money to arrive there. They have accrued a lot of debt back home, and backing out of these oppressive working conditions is not an option. We can also think about things like accommodation, because even when accommodation is provided, imagine arriving in a space that is new to you. even when accommodation is provided, sometimes it's completely substandard or inadequate for human habitation. Another issue is the right to join unions, the right to be able to participate in labor unions and associations. The legal status, once again, placed on some migrant workers effectively prohibits them from being able to do this basic thing, enjoying the fundamental right to association that is reflected in the ability to join and form trade unions for the protection of their interests. And, thinking of wage theft, manipulation, hazardous and unsafe working conditions, you can see how there is a whole intersection of challenges which migrant workers face. It's also intersection in terms of the fact that many of these challenges are exacerbated by factors such as age, ethnicity, gender, and other factors too. Sorry, yes.
If I may ask you to read the items on the diagram from the
left, sure.
Right, because it's too small to read it.
Thank you. Yes, I'm happy to do that. I apologize for the size. It looked clearer on my laptop when I did it. So at the bottom, you've got pre-departure. So this shows the journey of a migrant laborer, migrant worker who is using a kind of the facility of a recruiter and the different steps at which they often lose money. So at the very first stage, you've got the interview step, where some recruitment agencies will charge money. Then there is what's called skills testing, which I know firsthand because a relative back home in Ghana is trying to travel to the UK to work as a nurse, and the agency in question is asking her to pay $300 for skills testing, a fee which is completely illegal and shouldn't be charged. Then, assuming they haven't got the necessary documentation, there may be costs for securing a passport, for instance. In some countries, it's really hard to obtain a passport, and so you've got recruitment agencies which provide that service. That also comes at a cost. And then you have insurance costs, you have medical test costs, you've got visa fees. COVID test was there, but that's now no longer in place. But there are other costs related to health, such as yellow fever, tuberculosis, and others, which they have to pay. And then you have the actual, assuming everything's gone through, many migrant workers lose all the monies they've spent up to that stage because the process may fail or fall through. You've got a lot of exploitation in the system where people know clearly the jobs are non-existent, but they will still lead the worker up the path, making them believe that if they pay these monies to go through the first four or five steps, they will eventually get them a visa to travel. At the end, that may completely fall through. But assuming it does, then there is the travel cost itself. Some make it a precondition that they have to buy the ticket. So you can't buy your own air ticket. You have to pay the recruitment agency. They come up with all manner of excuses that, you know, we have to transport you in a group or whatever. So we have to buy all the tickets as in one go instead of individuals buying for their own tickets. And very often a commission may be placed on this. There is the airfare again. When COVID was in full flow, there were the quarantine costs as well. You've got border crossing fees. On arrival in the destination, there may be more medical tests to undertake. Then you've got residency permit or the right to work permit aspects of it too. Sometimes you've got orientation, an activity that, again, I've seen firsthand. They organize, what they call orientation, which I suppose if it's free, it can serve a very useful purpose to introduce workers to the society, the kinds of environment in which they're going to find themselves. That can be very valuable, but some recruitment agencies charge for these when they are being paid to do the same by the company which may be hiring them to recruit for them. And then you have got interest on the loans as well. So some might say that they can't afford it. The recruitment company might say to them, well, we can allow you to go through all these steps as a kind of loan, but because you are going to benefit upfront, we will put an interest on it, which can be sometimes 6 or 7 times the actual cost of the amount in question. And then for some, there is the return transportation. And so for many, as we saw in the debates around the kafala system during the World Cup, the dream of traveling to earn money becomes a nightmare, because by the time they return, they are actually in more debt than they began with. And many, therefore, decide it's not worth going back. They start to work clandestinely and then, you know, fall into other areas of exploitation in the informal labor market as well. Any other questions so far? We just getting to the end now, where I'll be asking you some questions myself. But if anybody's got a question, okay, thank you. Now, another, I suppose, less explored area in the challenges confronting migrant workers is the issue of deprivation to the right to family life, social and cultural rights, and so on and so forth. When I first arrived in the UK, I think I was a student initially, but I knew many people who were working, who were trying to bring their family to join them, who faced enormous challenges in trying to do so. British workers do not have to have a minimum amount of money before they can marry or, you know, enjoy family life. But that has been imposed on those who are not national. So if a migrant worker in Britain wants their wife to join them, they have to be earning at least, I think, £18,000, a figure that has probably gone up by now. I need to check it before they can bring their family. And even then, there are also other restrictions placed on the capacity for one's family to join them. And this only applies to those who are on long-term work visas, for instance. If you have a short-term one, that right is completely taken from you. And as a result, many lack support systems, because again, if you've arrived new in this country, for instance, you don't speak the language, you don't have a social network, you may be facing challenges at the workplace, and one's family provides the necessary support when they are available, but that is not the case for many. And so we see a lot of evidence of social exclusion, depression, and other adverse health impacts on migrant workers, ranging from things such as language barriers, which prevent them from being able to access even those provisions to which they are entitled, you know, for health, for instance. Unless you've got someone to translate for you in a clinic, it becomes a challenge at the shop, in all of these places. So before one can master the language of the country where they've arrived, you can face a lot of these challenges, coupled with the fact that, you know, you are separated from one's family and social support systems, which therefore creates sort of compounds the emotional and psychological challenges which migrant workers can often face. And as I was saying earlier, there is another group of migrant workers who are not captured in the data, and this relates to child migrants. This picture is from a recent documentary on CNN, which showed how lots of child migrants who've arrived in the USA from Honduras and other South American countries are increasingly been employed to work in meat processing factories, in other spaces, obviously clandestinely or illegally, and who are facing immense exploitation and violation of their rights, in part because of the fact that many of these children lack the due support from the state, and they are being exploited by the employers in question. There is the fact that children are relatively inexperienced. Not all children are, I should stress, because I think the capacity of anybody to make informed choices about their life is not simply a matter of how old they are. You can have a 16-year-old, for instance, who is very savvy, who is very engaged, who knows a lot about the world and about their rights, versus, say, a drug-addicted 60 or 70-year-old who has no interest in social events or public activities and so on and so forth. But the fact remains that, broadly speaking, children are more susceptible to exploitation, especially when they travel independently, and we see that clearly in this example, which was in the film, where many of them express the desire to work because of the fact that they have no support, and this has been capitalized upon by unscrupulous employers along the border regions who are, you know, using their labor and sometimes not even paying them at all, or a pittance, if any wages at all. And my own research of children's independent labor migration across West Africa also shows this. There is a long-standing sort of practice of young people traveling from their villages and hometowns in search of opportunities and income earning options elsewhere. And many of these are able to work in spaces such as construction sites, in farms and elsewhere, where they face immense challenges ranging from sheer exploitation through to sexual abuse and so on and so forth. We heard from the earlier slide that the sheer mention of the word migrant elicits sort of negative responses, which is quite unfortunate. So discourse that challenges this idea of sort of negativity around the contributions or the status of migrant workers will be helpful, but also ensuring that actual rights precede the interests of migration and border controls, because the reasons why we have a lot of the restrictions on migrant workers relates to sort of trying to protect borders, trying to protect supposedly the rights of citizen workers and so on and so forth, when in reality, these rights should be one and the same. Workers' rights should not be divisible or divided, in my view. But also the adoption of some of the wonderful laws that exist in conventions that already exist. We don't need to create new ones necessarily, because there are some really powerful ones in existence already, and what countries need to do is pay attention to them. So, you know, the Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Families, for instance, I was looking at it just last night, and I noticed that a beautiful country called Slovakia hasn't signed up to it yet, so maybe that's a good starting point for all of us to start advocating. But I thank you for your time.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia, as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.